City d'Orsay, and there was a kind of strange non-local connection between us. And this connection became real when I came back to Orsay in 74, and I visited a young professor, Christian Humbert, and I asked him, would you have something exciting to do for a PhD thesis? And he tells me, oh, there was a visiting professor, Abner Shimoni. He gave a talk on some strange subject. I don't know, it may be interesting. Here is a file. There are papers, PhD theses. Look into this file, and maybe you find something interesting. And when I opened the file, the first thing that was in there was Bell's paper, the famous small paper of John Bell. And the second paper was the paper with the CHSH inequalities. And as soon as I saw these two papers, I knew I wanted to work on this subject. That's the first connection between us. And the other connection, for which I think we should insist of your eminent role, I have talked to Mike Horn. I don't know if he's here, Mike. But I have talked to Mike Horn, and Mike Horn tells me how much you have been important for deriving the CHSH inequalities. Although you are a theorist, according to the witness of Mike, you understood almost from the beginning that we need inequalities that do not demand to demonstrate perfect correlation. And you had that in mind, and eventually you find these famous CHSH inequalities, which are the inequalities which are useful for experimentalists, because you don't have to assume that there is perfect correlation at a certain angle. So for all these reasons, you were so important in this work. Of course, you have all rights. Okay, that's interesting. So let me thank you for that also, because I was not at all sophisticated, and it was clear enough that even I could understand the derivation. So thank you for insisting on that. Nowadays, I'm not going to talk what happens. Ah, yes, that's the usual thing. We should go to presentation, otherwise it will go to sleep quite often. And presentation. Okay. Now should stop going off. Okay. Nowadays I'm not going to talk about EPR, at least not at the beginning, but because nowadays I'm working with atoms. Anyway, as probably everybody, the most important for me is my first love, and my first love was quantum optics. So nowadays I'm trying to work on quantum atom optics, and I'm going to give you an example of the kind of game we are trying to play. So what I'm going to talk about is the Humphrey-Brown and Twiss effect, and I will first give a review of why the Humphrey-Brown and Twiss effect was so important for the development of quantum optics. I've read many papers, and I have discovered that his effect had been extraordinarily important. And then we will proceed. So let us start by the review of what was the Humphrey-Brown and Twiss effect with light. Exactly 50 years ago, a paper was published in Nature by Mr. Humphrey-Brown and Mr. Twiss. So everybody remembers there were two, Mr. Humphrey-Brown and Mr. Twiss, not three of them, okay? And the experiment was the following. It was a mercury lamp shining on a pinhole, a beam splitter, and then two photomultipliers. And they looked at the correlation between the two photocurrents. So what they study is the correlation function between the two photocurrents here. If you assume in a classical view that the photocurrent here is proportional to the light intensity in the classical sense, then what you measure it's a correlation function of this light intensity here. And what they found was the following thing. You see, this is a schematic of the experiment. You have two photodetectors, and because there is a beam splitter, you can move them on top of each other and separate them along all three dimensions of space. And what they observe is the following thing. when they separate along the longitudinal dimension, which amounts to studying the correlation function versus a delay in time, okay, they find that at zero delay, there is an excess of correlation, and at large delay, there is no excess. This is a normalized correlation function. If the value is one, it means no correlation. The average of the product is equal to the product of the average. If it is bigger than one, there is correlation. The average of the product is bigger than the product of the average. If it is less than one, it is anti-correlation. Okay? We remember that for all this talk. So they found that there is correlation at zero delay, and the correlation disappears when the delay is larger than what? Than the time coherence of the light emitted by this source. This source is a non-monochromatic source, incoherent source. There is a time coherence. Then they do another experiment. They measure the correlation function versus lateral displacement, versus a distance between the detector, R2 minus R1. And again, they find that there is an excess of correlation when the two detectors are on top of each other, and it decreases to no correlation at all. Okay? And the width here is nothing else than the spatial coherence, which is about wavelengths of the light divided by the angle on which you see the source. In fact, this was a point that was interesting Mr. Humber, Brown, and Twiss, because they were astronomers and they wanted to measure the diameter of stars. And so the idea was the following. By looking at the, so you are looking at as a star, which is far away, which has an angular diameter alpha, and by changing the distance between the two detectors, you will see this correlation function decrease, and from that, you can infer the angular diameter of a star, okay? So you are going to tell me, but this is no different from the famous Michelson interferometer. Yes, it's totally different. In Michelson interferometer, what you are doing is having an interference between the two rays coming from the star, and you look here at the visibility of the fringes. And when the visibility decreases, then you can measure the diameter of the star. The problem with Michelson interferometer is that nobody can reproduce the experiments of Michelson. It's not that he was cheating. He was an extraordinary experimentalist. And what happens is because of atmospheric turbulence, the fringes are moving very fast. And Michelson was able to look at the fringes and say, here is a good visibility, and now the visibility is not as good. Nobody can do that nowadays, okay? Probably he was smarter than we are. On the contrary, we will see that these experiments here, the Humber, Brown, and Twiss experiment, is insensitive to atmospheric fluctuation. I'm going to explain you that. It's very interesting. So they did the experiment, and you see here a schematic of the experiment, and indeed, they could measure the diameter of Sirius. You see here when the two detectors are separated by 6 to 8 meters, the correlation function G2 minus 1 decreases, and from that, they correctly infer the diameter of Sirius. Why am I telling you all that? Well, because what is interesting is the explanation of the effect. Let us start with a simple explanation, the explanation they put first. It's an interpretation for classical optic people, a classical wave explanation. The idea is the following. You have many sources, independent. So the electric field here, for instance, is a sum of many independent random variables. So you can apply the central limit theorem, and you have a random process, which is a sum of many independent variables. It's a Gaussian process. And for a Gaussian process, it's well known that all higher moments can be expressed as a function of the second order moment. So for instance, G2, which in fact is a fourth order moment in electric field, okay? Because G2 is a correlation of intensity, but intensity is a square of the electric field. So G2, which is a fourth order moment, can be expressed as a function of G1. G1 is what Mr. Michelson was measuring. G2 is what Mr. Humber, Brown, and Mr. Twiss are measuring, okay? And indeed, they do the same measurement, so they can measure the coherence of the light that they receive from the source, and from that, they can infer the size of the star. Okay, so far, so good. another way, in a more modern way of looking at this interference, speckle. This Gaussian random process produces a speckle. The speckle is what you have when a light beam is passing through a random phase and you see this speckle. And what you measure is the correlation radius of these grains of speckle. And these grains of speckle change all the time, and this is why if there is a delay tau, the signal goes to zero. Okay, that's another way of understanding the signal. You are measuring the radius of the speckle grain here. And the third explanation, which allows us to understand why it is insensitive to atmospheric turbulence, is to look at two particular components, two different frequencies, one which I draw in green here, one which I draw in blue. So look at this detector. There is a bit knot between the green and the blue component. Here I have a bit knot between the green and the blue component. And I will have correlation signal different from one, G2 will be different from one, if the bit signal here and the bit signal here are in phase. Which means that the path difference here must not change too much when you go from one point to the other one. Why is it important to understand it this way? And it was the way Mr. Humbery-Brand presented this stuff. Is that now you understand that if you think of phase fluctuation due to the atmospheric fluctuation, what is important is to compare the change in optical path. You want to compare it not to the optical wavelengths of the light, but you want to compare it to the wavelength associated to the bit note. And the bit note is in the gigahertz range, which means a wavelength of the order a little less than 1 meter. In the Michelson experiment, what you want is that the atmospheric fluctuations are less than optical wavelengths, which is a micron. In Humbery-Brand-Twiss experiment, you want that the atmospheric fluctuations are less than the wavelengths associated to gigahertz, that is of the order of 30 centimeters. So you understand why the Humbery-Brand and Twiss experiment is insensitive to atmospheric fluctuation. Okay, so far so good, but again, this is not really quantum optics. Where is quantum optics? Quantum optics came from the fact that Mr. Humbery-Brand and Mr. Twiss received a very cold, not to say more, welcome. Everybody jumped on them and say, this is totally stupid, it will never work, and you are not going to have money. And the argument was the following. Look, if you think of these experiments not in terms of classical waves, if you think of it in terms of photons, you are telling me that two photons emitted from two opposite sides of Sirius are going not to be independent when they come on my detector? Absolutely stupid. It will never work. Mr. Humbery-Brand was so disgusted that he left England, emigrated to Australia. Apparently, kangaroo do not know about quantum mechanics, so they did not make the objection about the photon, and they gave him money, and he could do the experiment in Australia. And he did all his career in Australia. Okay. Anyway, it was a hot debate, okay, and he had to answer these arguments. So this strong negative, after this strong negative reaction, Mr. Humbery-Brand and Mr. Twiss began to say, well, first, we show that it does exist. And this is why they did this, between quote, toy experiment with a mercury lamp. They did the mercury lamp because of the negative reaction to their application for a grant to do the experiment, okay? And they began to argue that, in fact, in quantum mechanics, you should not only think of photons as billiard balls, but light is both wave and particle. And they established this formula that I have shown to you, but they correctly reinterpreted it in saying that the one here corresponds to fluctuation due to independent particles, what we call nowadays shot noise, okay? And this is a term which is due to the bit knot between waves with random phases. And last year, it was 2005, and I have read a lot of Einstein, and I have read a fantastic paper among many of Einstein. In 1909, Einstein gave a talk in Salzburg, and we have the proceedings of this talk. It was about light, which is both a wave and particle. And he studied the fluctuation of the blackbody radiation. And by one of these arguments of Einstein, where he put particle radiation, a piston, and look at the thermodynamics and things like that, he came to this formula. And Einstein correctly said, this term shows, this term corresponds to independent particles, this term corresponds to bit knots between random waves, and the fact that I have the two terms in the fluctuation of blackbody radiation proves that light is both wave and particle. Just an incident remark, but incidental remark, but not uninteresting. Let's go back to Mr. Humphrey Brown and Twiss. So they come with his arguments. Anyway, they do not really convince people. He goes to Australia. And then comes the first convincing quantum mechanical interpretation of the effect. It was first Fano, a small paper in American Journal of Physics, and then Roy Glauber. And the explanation goes along the following lines, which are well explained with the toy model. The toy model is the following. You have two atoms excited and two detectors on the ground state. And the two atoms are going to emit, and at the end, the two detectors are going to be excited, and the two atoms are going to be in the ground state. And I will have to change my batteries, which is okay. I can talk and change batteries simultaneously, probably. So you see, you have initial state, two atoms excited, and detector in the ground state. And final situation is the two atoms in the ground state. Well, the problem is, yes, I find it. And final state is two atoms in the ground state and two detectors excited. And of course, there are two ways for going from the initial state to the final state. The first way is that one atom emits a photon, which is detected by the first detector. And the other way is that you cross, you reverse the detectors. Okay, let's hope it will work. Good. Okay, so here, first process, here, the second process. You cannot distinguish these two processes. Same initial state, same final state. So there is an interference between the two amplitudes, and there is a factor of two. And this is the explanation for the factor of two. Okay. This, I think, is extremely important. It may well be the first example of a two-particle interference effect. This is not at all an interference in ordinary space. It's an interference with amplitudes related to two photon states. So I think, in a sense, it's the precursor of all these modern things like entanglement, Mandeldeep, etc., etc. On the other hand, if you think to the first explanation I gave, it is absolutely a trivial effect for a radio engineer. It tells you nothing more than the average of the square of the intensity is larger than the square of the average, and you have a factor of two just because you have a Gaussian statistics period. So I think it's interesting to realize that. So with this remark, I like to make another remark. Let's suppose you do an Humphrey-Brown-Twiss experiment with fermions. What are you going to observe? The same reasoning tells you that the interference will be with a negative sign. That is, rather than having a factor of two, you are going to have zero. So what you expect is that, rather than having a bump, you are going to have a dip, okay? And for this, there is no classical interpretation. Because if you would look for a classical interpretation, it would mean that you would have the average of the square smaller than the square of the average. And this cannot happen in classical physics. This would violate a Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. So in a sense, for fermions, it would be more quantum mechanical than with bosons or photons. Okay, it's not the end of the story. I'm a little long, but it is a very interesting story. Confusion increased a lot with the discovery of laser. Because Humphrey-Bryant Twiss effect was 1956. Laser was invented in 1960. And then it was a start of absolutely hot discussion. And for instance, in 1961, Mandel and Wolf predicted that in a laser, you would very easily observe the Humphrey-Bryant Twiss effect. And immediately, Roy Glauber came into the landscape and look at what they were writing in a physical review letter at that time. The fact that photon correlations are enhanced by narrowing the spectral bandwidth has led to a prediction of large-scale correlation to be observed in the beam of an optical maser, that is a laser. We shall indicate that this prediction is misleading and follows from an inappropriate model of the maser beam, okay? So you see, it was not very academic tone, but Glauber made the reasoning that you should have G2 equal 1, that is to say, statistical independence for the photons in a laser beam. In 1965, Armstrong made the first demonstration of this. He had a laser beam going out of one of the first semiconductor laser, and he found that below threshold, that is to say, below threshold when you have like a thermal radiation, it looks like a narrowband blackbody source, but above threshold, that is to say, when you have a laser beam, its noise is characteristic of a quieted amplitude stabilized oscillator. Okay. Then there was an experiment of Arecchi in Italy, and with the first plot showing directly the bump for a thermal-like light and the flat correlation function, G2 equal 1 for all values of the separation for laser light. This was 1966. And again, the point that I would like to make, what's going on here? The point that I want to make is that to demonstrate this with a quantum theory, it needs the expertise of Roy Glauber. But if you are a naive optician, you describe laser light by a wave with a constant amplitude and a phase which is a random variable. And when you take the square modulus of this, then the intensity is absolutely quiet, and you are not surprised that the average of the square is equal to the square of the average. You are not surprised that G2 has a value of 1. So again, for light, you can understand everything from a fully classical point of view. Okay, so I hope I have convinced you that, interesting as it is, because it started quantum optics, in fact, the Humphrey-Bryant Twiss effect can be fully understood from a classical point of view. But if you take the point of view that you have particles and not waves, then you have the real quantum awareness. So what about the Humphrey-Bryant and Twiss effect with real massive particles? Okay, photons, we don't know, okay? Real particles, massive particles. This is a beautiful experiment that was done 10 years ago by Shimizu in Japan. And what he did was having a beam of cold atoms, something like a pinhole, a lens. I don't want to go into the details, but eventually he got the Humphrey-Bryant and Twiss bump for G2 of tau, that is to say, versus the delay. This was a wonderful experiment. It was so difficult that they could not make a complete study of G2 versus the separation between the detector, but it was a wonderful experiment. In the recent years, it seems that people working with cold atoms have discovered the power of looking at what we call in optics intensity correlation, and what we call in cold atoms density correlation function. And so you have, for instance, a beautiful experiment that was done by Eric Cornell and Carl Wieman in 1997, in which they compare a rate of collision for a thermal cloud, in which you have fluctuation, and a Bose-Einstein condensate, which is basically like a laser beam, something with a smooth density that does not fluctuate. And they find, indeed, the Hambury-Brown and twist factor, which turns out to be factorial of 3 because it's 3-body collision. So it's not a factor of 2, it's a factor of 6. So they found that. And there are many other experiments, including us. We have looked at atomic density fluctuation and found the factor of 2, etc. This is not direct Hambury-Brown twist effect, but it's interesting. Something which is a direct equivalent of Hambury-Brown twist effect, and there is this beautiful paper by Gordon Bame, and if you don't have Acta Physica Polonica in your library, just go to archive and you find the paper on archive, the preprint. It turns out that people measure the size of nuclei just like Mr. Hambury-Brown and twist were measuring the angular diameter of stars. So go into this paper and you will see that. So this is another example. What about fermionic particles? Well, this is another story. There are experiments with a 2D electron gas in a semiconductor, and I must confess that I don't feel comfortable to understand this experiment because electron in a semiconductor, you know, have dressed particles and things like that, but it seemed convincing. There is an experiment with a low-density electron beam. Why low density? Because electrons are charged particles. They repel each other. So if you want really to see the Hambury-Brown twist effect, you must be sure that it is not a trivial Coulomb repulsion, okay? And there is recently an experiment with a beam of neutron. So neutrons are fermions, and they don't repel each other because of trivial Coulomb effect, and they have observed the dip corresponding to fermions. What about atoms? We'll come to this point later. Now, I go to the experiments we have been doing in recent years along these lines with a unique system that we have developed in my lab, which is using ultra-cold metastable helium and developing a space and time-resolved single-atom detector. And with that, we have been able to make a complete atomic Hambury-Brown twist experiment, and I'm going to describe that. First, what is metastable helium? Metastable helium is a state in which the two electrons have parallel spin. And you know that the states with parallel electron spins and the state with antiparallel electron spins basically don't communicate to each other. There are very strong selection rules that tells you you cannot go from a singlet state to a triplet state by absorbing or emitting radiation, okay? Which means that for all practical purposes, once you are with the two parallel spins, you are in a set of levels, and this is the lowest of this triplet state with parallel spins, and it plays the role of a ground state. And with this, you can use, for instance, this resonance transition in the infrared for decelerating a beam, trapping the atoms, cooling them, and even getting a Bose-Einstein condensate. On the other hand, the real ground state with two antiparallel electrons is 20 electron volts lower. When an atom in this state comes close to a piece of matter, it experiences an electric field. And because of the motion, there is a motional magnetic field. And this motional magnetic field can reverse one of the spin of the electron. And so you can make a transition from this state to that state, and then there are 20 electron volts of energy available. 20 electron volts is huge. It's more than enough for making an ionization of anything, a piece of matter, a molecule, another atom, etc. Which means that if an atom like that comes on a piece of metal, there will be an electron extracted. And if there is an electron extracted, you can accelerate it, attract it to an electron multiplier, and you will have a macroscopic pulse. This is the equivalent of photon counting. It's single atom counting. We can detect one atom after the other one. Okay? With that, so this is the idea of our scheme. It's an artist's view, but it's not very different. These are magnetic coils for trapping the metastable helium atoms here, you release, or the atom fall, onto this detector, and this detector is a series of many electron multipliers. It's small channels, any channel is an electron multiplier. It's a MCP, microchannel plate detector. So each time an atom comes here, an electron is extracted, and on the other side of the plate, you have a macroscopic pulse that you can see on a detector, on a scope, okay, or a counter or anything. Okay? With this, we have been able to demonstrate that we can obtain Bose-Einstein condensation of metastable helium. To make a long story short, this was discovered in 2001. To make a long story short, this is a time of flight. What does it mean? At time t equals zero, we release the atoms and we look at the distribution of the time of arrival. When the atoms are hot, hot means hundreds of microkelvin, then you have time of flight here, okay? And when you cool the atom, you see that the maximum of the time of flight go to lower and lower values. The idea is the following. When the atoms are hot, the initial velocity dominates gravity. So the peak of the time of flight just reflects the initial velocity. But when they become slow, initially slow, then everything is dominated by gravity and all the atoms arrive on the detector. And you can fit all that, and finally we obtain the signal that proves that we have Bose-Einstein condensation. Why do I show you that? It's because I show you that just we have a control for having either a sample of thermal atoms or having a Bose-Einstein condensate. We can control, we cool more or less. If we cool less, we have cold but thermal sample. If we cool more, then we have a Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay? So we will be able to do Humphrey-Bryant twist experiment with thermal sample or with a Bose-Einstein condensate, which should be like a laser. Before doing this experiment, we had to develop something more. Here, you have the microchannel plate detector, and what we want to know is not only that an atom arrives somewhere, but we want to know where it arrives. And for that, we implement delay lines. When the pulse is here, the charge produces two pulses that go to the two ends of a delay line. And by looking at the time difference between the two ends here, you can reconstruct the point where the atom was detected. Of course, the system will be better if it travels slower. So there is a trick to have the pulse traveling slower. Rather than having a wire like that, you have a coil. And so goes like that, goes slower, it improves the resolution. Anyway, the resolution is not as good as expected. The resolution is only 200 micrometer, but this detector has a size of about 5 centimeters, which means that we have something that 10 to the fourth detector working in parallel. I mean that when atom arrives here, we know that it arrives here by just doing that. This question of detector resolution is very important for the Humphrey-Bryant twist experiment. Because look, you are expecting a bump here. But if your resolution is bigger than the size of the bump, what you are doing is a convolution, and you are reducing the signal. So you don't want to have a too bad resolution. How is it in our experiment? I don't go into the details, which are written here. In our experiment, the source is cigar-shaped. It's because the atoms are trapped in a harmonic potential which has a strong asymmetry. It's a shallow trap along one direction and a stiff trap along two transverse dimensions. And so the distribution of position in the trap is very elongated. Now, the Humphrey-Bryant twist signal is the coherence, first order coherence, well, second order, which is proportional to the first order. And this is a Fourier transform of the distribution in the source at the Zernike-Vansittart theorem, which means that if you have a long cigar like that, what you are expecting is to have a sort of pancake. And this is the shape of the coherence function, and this is the size of the detector, which shows that along the y direction, our detector has a resolution good enough not to affect the signal, but along X, the detector is bigger than this dimension, so it will make a convolution and reduce the signal. Well, that's a fact it is. It's better to do an experiment with an imperfect system than to do no experiment at all. So we decided to do it. We are expecting a reduction factor of 15. So how do we proceed? I think this is very interesting to understand what we are doing. We have here a sample of cold atoms. We release at time t equals zero, we release the atoms, and each time an atom comes somewhere, we register the time of detection and the position. And we have a collection of all these events, and this is what we call one record. And then we make another cloud, repeat another record. Another cloud, we repeat another record, okay? And now, what are we going to do with that? For a given record, that is an ensemble of detection events corresponding to the same sample, we look at the correlation function. That is to say, now we have the record, we take an event, and we ask the question, do we have another event separated from the first one by a certain delay, by a certain distance? We plot an histogram, and on this histogram, we see absolutely nothing. Looks like noise. But now we do it on the second record, correlation record by record. And then we average over the various correlation on individual records. And then suddenly you have a beautiful signal that grows up, and this is the Humphrey-Brown and Twist bump here. So it's not a factor of two, it's a factor 1.05, but the signal to noise ratio is clear, and we have the expected reduction factor of 15. So this is like the Shimizu experiment. But then with our beautiful detector, we can also study, it's all in the record, all the data are in the computer. We can also study the transverse correlation function. And here it's plotted in two dimensions. Here you have a correlation bigger than, I mean the G2 is bigger than one. Here it's one, so here no correlation. And you see indeed an elongated shape, which looks like the Fourier transform of the shape of the source, okay? So we really have the complete study of the Humphrey-Brown-Twiss effect. And of course, the next thing is to change the size of the source. Because if we change the size of the source, we change the width of the correlation function. And to change the size of the source, we just change the temperature of the cold atoms in the source. Because the hotter the atoms, the bigger the cloud. So here you see a larger temperature, bigger cloud, smaller correlation function. Smaller cloud, bigger correlation function, and it more or less fits the theory. Okay. Now, as I told you, in the Humphrey-Brown and Twiss effect, it was very important to understand the difference between a thermal sample and a laser beam. So here, we want to see the difference between a thermal sample and a Bose-Einstein condensate, which looks like a laser beam, which is the equivalent of a laser beam. We did it, and at the same time, there was an experiment in Zurich in which people have atoms extracted from a Bose-Einstein condensate. It's what we call an atom laser. And with a high finesse cavity, they can detect atoms one per one. They don't have spatial resolution, but they have longitudinal resolution, and they observe G2 of tau for R2 minus R1 equals zero. I forgot the zero. They find something absolutely flat, which means no correlation at all. And there is another test. They look at the distribution, and it looks like a Poisson distribution, which indeed corresponds to uncorrelated events. But of course, they don't have spatial resolution, so they cannot make the full study. So here, we have done, with our detector, we have done the full study, and the full study shows that G2 equals one along all three directions, okay? There is, for a Bose-Einstein condensate, there is no doubt all the atoms look like being totally statistically independent, between quotes. Okay. I claim complete study of the atomic Humphrey-Brown and Twiss effect. So if I claim complete, what about fermionic atoms? Such an experiment had never been made, but I'm not joking, I received last night a mail from Amsterdam announcing that we have observed fermionic Ambury-Brennan-Twiese effect with atom. What we have done is a collaboration between the group of Wim Wassen in the Free University of Amsterdam, because they have developed in the last years, they have developed the way of having a sample of helium-3. Helium-3 is a fermion, obviously. And they have developed a method for having ultra-cold helium-3 atoms at a temperature below the Fermi temperature, something like half the Fermi temperature, something like that. And we have the beautiful detector. So we have decided to bring our beautiful detector to Amsterdam. In addition, our best PhD student on this program, Martin Schelkens, is bilingual, French and in Netherlands. So it helps for the collaboration. And here are the results I have received on my mail. Rather than having a bump here, you have a dip at the origin. So there is a dip corresponding to the Ambury-Brown and Twiese negative correlation for fermions. And here you have the spatial correlation function. Blue here correspond to G2 equal 1, and dark correspond to G2 less and less than 1, okay? So here you have indeed a hole in the correlation function, and here you have 1, and this delta x equals 0, delta y equals 0, and you see the hole here. So, of course, these preliminary results, and in the same apparatus, they can have bosonic metastable helium. So they are going now to compare helium-4 and helium-3 and with the same apparatus, okay? So that's the experiment they are doing. Okay, now, especially for you, Abner, I have a last part. Towards CHSH test with entangled metastable helium atoms. I want to remind you that the possibility to measure photon correlations is really the hardcore of modern quantum optics, the possibility of measuring this G2. This is Ambury-Brennan-Twiese experiment. This is the next very important experiment. It's the Burnham and Weinberg experiment. In this experiment, or Burnham and Weinberg, which is trivial from our modern perspective, but which apparently was a shock at that time. The idea is the following. You have a laser beam, and here a nonlinear crystal, and the famous parametric down splitting. That is to say, frequency omega gives two beams at frequency omega divided by 2, omega divided by 2. It's a chi-2 nonlinear process, okay? But if you can think of it in terms of CW beams. But people began to have the idea, maybe in this process, it is one photon at frequency omega, which is split into a pair of photons at frequency omega over 2, omega divided by 2. Can we see that? And in 1970, Burnham and Weinberg did the experiment in which they have a fast photomultiplier, and look at the correlation. And what they find, indeed, is that there is a strong correlation in these beams, which means that although everything looks stable, static, stationary, in fact, if you look at correlation, photon per photon, the photons are emitted by pairs. And this was a starting point for all the modern experiments of producing entangled photon, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, there was the atomic cascade, these kind of things. But it was really the beginning of understanding that pairs of photons are really very important. Okay. Now, thinking to all that, this is a program I wrote a few years ago when we found that we have this beautiful detector. And so I say, we are going to try to do with atoms what people have done with photons. So the Ambury-Brennan-Twiese type experiment, we have done it, and we have done more than that because there are no fermionic photons, so we have done more. Where this is fluctuation atom laser and this is another story, a little more technical. Detection of correlated atom pairs in four-wave mixing. What do I mean? A few years ago, Bill Phillips and his group in NIST and Wolfgang Ketterle and his group have demonstrated the following thing. If you take two Bose-Einstein condensates and you throw them against each other, then because of the interaction, you have a collision, which is equivalent to a nonlinear optical effect. And you have something like four-wave mixing. Four-wave mixing in optics means that you have several wave ins, several wave out, and a total of four waves, okay? And this four-wave mixing process means that you, for instance, in this process where you have a collision between two Bose-Einstein condensate, then you expect two daughter BECs. I don't know why BECs are females, but that's what they use in the literature. So you have two daughter BECs. And the interesting point is the following. You can write energy and momentum conservation at individual atomic level. I mean, the Bose-Einstein condensate, you consider it as a collection of atoms all with the same momentum and the same energy. And the other one also. So when you think of conservation of energy and momentum, it's for one atom and one atom going one atom and one atom, okay? And so this put constraints on P3 and P4, and this is an example of what they observed, and this is analogous to what people call phase matching in nonlinear optics. Okay. The question that I asked myself is the following. Here, you have two Bose-Einstein condensate, and you get out two Bose-Einstein condensate. If we go to low enough density, can we have well-separated pairs, atom pairs produced? Just like in parametric down correlation or this standard nonlinear optics process. And the answer is yes. This experiment has been done a few weeks ago before we left for Amsterdam, so we have interrupted this experiment, but these preliminary results are very encouraging. The situation we have designed is following. We choose the case where P2 equals minus P1. Then you have a degenerate situation where P4 will be equal to minus P3, but there is no constraint on the direction. So in fact, what you expect is pairs along any direction. So you expect these pairs in the momentum space to be on a sphere. Without detector, we can reconstruct the sphere. Why? We do the collision at a well-defined time. And then we detect events here at a well-known moment at a well-known position. It's just Newtonian mechanic, free-fall, to reconstruct the initial P. So this is what is done here. And here, this is really preliminary result, okay? But this is slices of the expected sphere. And indeed, you see here, you are on the top of the sphere. You go through the sphere. Here, you clearly see you are at the equator, okay? Here, you are at the equator, and you go at the bottom of the sphere. You see a ring, and now you are really at the bottom of the sphere. There is another way of processing the data, is for each event, you can compute the modulus of the momentum, and then you see that there is a well-defined modulus, which means, yes, the atoms are produced on a sphere, okay? Now, do we have correlation between an atom emitted this way and an atom emitted that way? The answer is yes. This is, again, an histogram that we do for each event. We ask the question, do we have a correlation with antipode or with neighbor to the antipode and things like that? And here you have the result. Yes, there is a strong correlation with the opposite direction on the momentum sphere, which means that indeed, this is like the Burnham and Bider experiment. Indeed, now we are able to produce individual pairs of atoms like that. Okay. Next question. Can we have entanglement? Well, probably yes. If we trust quantum mechanics, we should have superposition of this pair state plus this pair state plus other one, but let us concentrate on two of them, okay? So let's suppose we have something like that. Can we evidence entanglement? Yes, and for this, Abner, we go to this old paper called it was two-particle interferometry. Michael and Anton will excuse me, but this talk is in your honor, so I highlight your name in this paper. And so the idea is the following. With modern technology, we know how to make mirrors for atoms by Bragg scattering. We know how to make beam splitter for atoms for Bragg scattering. So what we are going to do, we have the atom going like that, and they will fall due to gravity. But with laser beams like that, we can implement mirrors, beam splitters. So we will have a scheme like that, reflect a beam splitter to detector. On the other side, reflect, beam splitter, detector. We can also, with a trick with laser, we can tune a phase shift here, a phase shift here. We don't need two, but it's better to have two. And then we will look at the correlation between detectors, between these detectors, and if we trust quantum mechanics, a test of Bell CHSH inequality should be possible. Well, maybe we'll have results in the next conference in your honor, Abner. I don't know. And with this, I'm going to thank you. And these are the people responsible for this result. Martin Schelkens with PhD, Chris Wellsbrook, a senior collaborator, Denis Boirong, another senior collaborator, Hong Chang, a Chinese postdoc, and Valentina, the name doesn't show, but she's Italian. Okay. So these are the people who have done this, this work. Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry I didn't know this paper, but okay, yes, thank you, it's very interesting. So we have no disagreement on that. Yes. 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 Oh, because the deep we see with fermions, there is no extra phase factor added by a beam splitter. I mean, the deep that you have on the Mandel deep, we understand it in a classical way by the fact that there is an extra pi factor in a beam splitter. So again, here, without detector, there is no beam splitter. What we are looking at is really density correlation function. And having it's directly a density correlation function. There is no beam splitter, nothing, okay? And the fact that the density correlation function exhibits a dip at zero separation, this is absolutely non-classical. It violates the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, that average of the square of the density should be bigger than the square of the average if it were classical quantity and not quantum operators. So it's the fact that in our experiment, remember, our detector, there is no beam splitter. It's directly, we build the correlation function directly. Yeah, but the dip is easy to understand with an extra pi, period. Okay, in the last result, it's preliminary result. When an experimentally presents you preliminary result, don't ask him if it is Bayesian or something like that. He likes to show you something, and you decide either you are convinced or you are not convinced, period. I don't claim more. Now, on older experiment, then it's standard methods of experimental physics. You do the statistics on the histograms you are making, and you are making something like a Gaussian assumption or something like that, and you estimate error bars, and that's it. I mean, everybody does it that way. I mean, there is nothing special. I mean, and again, what you have to realize is that qualitatively, the result do not change by the method you use to infer the width of error bars or things like that. I mean, there is no special. It's a whole body of well-known experimental physics, and there is no mystery. Once you have the events, then it becomes normal statistics, ordinary statistics. Okay, you are welcome to look in all these papers and reinterpret them. That the strength of an experimentalist, he produces results, we interpret the results according to the general agreement between experimentalists doing photon counting, atom counting, and things like that. I mean, but I think the results are clear enough. I mean, there is a bump or there is a dip. I mean, this you cannot discuss, I mean, for instance, you know. Say again the question. Yes. Yes. Well, okay, I understand. You're asking me, can we do an ideal CHSH experiment, including having space-like separation? In a single detector, which is a few centimeters, this would demand picosecond time resolution, which is hardly on the limit of what you can have with MCP. MCP are faster than photomultipliers, okay? But anyway. But nothing prevents you from having a higher vacuum chamber. Rather than having a height of fall of 4 centimeters, you can have a higher vacuum chamber and having 2 detectors. So I think there is no big difficulty. I don't know if we will do it, okay, because this is done so easily with photons, but if we want to do it in principle, there is no big difficulty in having a separation of 30 centimeters. 30 centimeters is 1 nanosecond. 1 nanosecond is clearly bigger than the time resolution of this MCP, which is better than 100 picoseconds. So if we want to make space-like separation, we can. Do we want to do it? This is another story, okay? But yes, in principle. Well, I think if the detector had a sensitivity bigger than 80%, then it would be worth doing it, because we would have an experiment in which both loopholes are closed simultaneously. But I doubt at this point that our detectors have an efficiency bigger than 80%. We don't know yet. We are going to be able to measure it, because as soon as you have pairs, you can estimate the absolute value of detectors. Until this point, we just estimated like that. We look at papers, and all people evaluate it roughly. We don't know exactly what is the sensitivity of the detector. If it turned out that the detector has a sensitivity bigger than 80%, then I would consider having an experiment in which we have the two loopholes closed simultaneously. I doubt that we are going to have that. We will see. It's really, I'm not cheating. It's really completely preliminary result. But we are so excited, I mean, to see this sphere. And then we ask the student, look for correlation. And you have to understand, it's very complicated. It looks simple. You say, it's just Newtonian mechanics to reconstruct. But when you have a big bunch of data, it becomes serious question for computer and things like that. And as soon as a student came with this correlation, we are very excited. So. Anton wants to ask a question. Yeah. Yes, I know. Yes. Yes. It's not interferon fringe. It's a Humber-Riemann twist intensity correlation signal. There is no fringe in the Humber-Riemann twist. I didn't know of that. Well, I have to read again the book, because I have the book of Humber-Riemann twist, okay? I have to look into the book to see if he mentioned that. But if you mention this point, I can tell you that I could have given another talk. The real Wheeler daily choice experiment has been done recently by my friend Jean-François Roch and his team, with single photon, real source of single photon, and a daily choice experiment on a 50-meter length. And these results will be published soon. But so it's in the same spirit, but with real single photon source. That is a source in which you can show that you emit one photon and not a Poisson distribution. Unfortunately, no, Abner. I wish I had. Well, signal to noise ratio at that point is so weak. We cannot tell, because if we believe calculation, you have an expansion, okay, and the 3 and 4 are weaker, okay? We deliberately choose to have low density, because we didn't want to have a blurp of atoms and a blurp of atoms. What we wanted to see, do we have pairs? So we deliberately decompress the stuff to have low density. So 3 and 4 are probably lower. But of course, our friends, theorists of quantum optics, you know, from Australia and these people, push us and say, oh, but if you have large density, you have very interesting. But I want to have pairs. I don't want to have big beams. So